Welcome to another episode of the Reboot Chronicles, a no-holds-barred forum with global leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and CEOs about how organizations stay focused on growth and innovation in unprecedented times. I'm your host, Dean DeBias, coming to you live from Reviv's North American headquarters in Chicago, and we would like to thank you for joining us from around the globe today. I'd like to welcome Libor Mihalik to the Reboot Chronicles. He is the president of Affirm, the leading payment network that helps merchants drive growth and provides consumers with some purchase optionality. You know, American consumers spend anywhere close to $1 trillion a year or have $1 trillion a year in outstanding credit card debt, depending on how you measure it. And with the rapid growth of buy now, pay later offered at almost every merchant category now, from furniture to flights to food, Affirm is becoming a systemic part of the merchant and consumer transaction ecosystem. With the $15.5 billion funding capacity, the company has over 50 million consumers that have come onto the platform that generated $7.5 billion in gross merchandise value through their 277,000 partners and counting. And that delivered them about $1.6 billion in total annual revenue in their last fiscal year. So pretty exciting stuff. Libor, it's good to see you.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you for having me. Really excited to be here and talk about Affirm and what we've been up to.
Yeah, you got a great story, as everyone knows. And there's always two sides to the story. You know, no one likes to hear that Americans, North Americans have $1 trillion in credit card debt, but we can get into that. I just love that as a Silicon Valley guy, ran a lot of companies out there, lived right near you. Just, I just love the way the platform took off. And you got such a massive share of this buy now, pay later marketplace. You know, how did this just come about? I mean, did it just grow like crazy and everything was right? Or were there a lot of reboots along the way?
There's building a company and growing a company is certainly, I don't think it's any surprises, challenging, and there's plenty of challenges along the way, as we scaled to where we are today. But, the mission and the idea and then ultimately the strategy, the mission of building honest financial products that improve people's lives, and then the strategy for how we think about building those products, delivering credit on a per purchase basis, aligned with the interests of the customer, and how we thought about scaling that out. That's been really consistent throughout. And so, of course, there's no shortage of hiccups and roadblocks as you're going down that journey. But one of the things is that's been helpful is having that North Star and having that vision to stay true to and continuing to execute against it.
Yeah. Yeah. Patient investors and funding obviously helps there a lot. But I'm always struck by, we can get into your business model in a minute, but just, why didn't the big dog banks do this, first of all? Why aren't they at the center of this and owning it? You know, they've got things like Zelle, the nine of them. We can talk about peer-to-peer later, but it's just remarkable that it took a little startup to create a whole new category that, quite frankly, layaway was back in the old Sears catalog days. It's almost like a retro.
100%. I mean, it is back to the future in the sense that it was really something that is like, how do you take credit back to the core principles, right? Of like, there's things that are more valuable to have now than 12 months from now, and you're willing to pay some extra money to have that mattress, that couch, that suit for an interview like today versus, waiting for it for 12 months. And, that is kind of what we went back to. There was really, part of the inception was was rooted in really four technologies kind of occurring at roughly contemporaneously at the same time that enabled it. The shift to e-commerce, the rise of mobile, really good machine learning and modeling and access to data, real-time access to consumer data about consumers, kind of those things all being available roughly, 15-ish years ago, really enabled us to say, okay, with these capabilities, how do we offer this product? And then being able to do so. And being able to underwrite the individual and the purchase in real time at the point of sale, and then being able to give them clear terms, clear understanding of this is what it's going to cost you all in as a part of the decision process, as a part of the bill, right, that they're being presented, and then deciding, okay, this is worth it to me, or this is not worth it to me, and you know, being able to then deliver on that promise. So that's really kind of where we started, what we've been doing ever since. As for, I think there's a few things that are stood in the way of the big banks being able to do that, at least initially. Part of it is the business model and just the approach to the consumers, right? Credit cards are largely premised and making the bulk of their profits when the unexpected or unwanted happens. You know, they sell ubiquity and convenience, but the money comes from events that nobody thinks is going to happen. Nobody thinks, I'm just going to start I'm going to not pay my full bill, and then I'm going to start paying interest on everything that I do.
Right.
That's not how people enter it, but that's where
it's got a 1960s connotation to it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the idea of, you know, the banks entering into a product that's going to cannibalize credit cards, but with a lower margin, lower revenue for them product, I think posed challenges. But then there's also structural technological elements of the card networks, the kind of information that they are able to provide on a per transaction basis really precluded the large providers from being able to provide that per purchase decision making capability and underwriting in the moment in real time, really focusing on creating the concept of the line of credit and a structure where they're underwritten once a year, once every other year for a certain amount, and that's what follows the user. Well, we realize that we can get much higher fidelity in terms of not just underwriting and understanding whether the consumer can or can't pay us back on this purchase, but also how to price it, right? Can we offer 0%? Is it an interest bearing? Is it for the full amount? Is it for a part of the amount? All of those became unlocks to being able to underwrite more users and support a larger user base than you can when you're underwriting a credit card on a multi-year time horizon.
Yeah, I mean, you're being very polite to the both the issuer, Visa, MasterCard.
I wasn't trying to be.
They're probably going to be on soon, and a couple of the big banks are as well, but. You know, even Zelle, the CEO of Zelle is going to be able to talk about it in a second. But what I love about what you just said in your platform is it's simplicity. So if I'm buying a, expensive ticket on United or American, it's just, hey, it's $43 a month. I never add up times how many months and see how much you're making there. I've never done that. But I love the way it's just on demand, real time. It's very transparent. But in another way, you kind of democratize the decision by being a, very kind of, allow the consumer to kind of take control and say, hey, I could do this. Does it also help the I'll just call them merchants, but there's all types in your categories to, cross sell, upsell, get a bigger shopping basket?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's part of the proposition is that because not just the underwriting, not just the feedback to the consumer, but the pricing itself is happening in real time. And so to the extent that the merchant is interested and capable of providing some of that pricing, thereby buying down the customer's interest, buying down some of the risk and allowing for larger amounts of exposure, that is what we can pass on to the consumer. And that's why we have a fairly large share of 0% offerings across our merchant base, where some of them go out to 2-3 years. A lot of that pricing of being able to offer 0% to the consumer for that period of time is the merchant not using Affirm's analytical tools and those capabilities to really understand that, hey, the amount of incremental revenue and sales I'm going to get as a result of offering 0% is going to, is going to be far outweigh the cost of doing that. Something that, a lot of more and more merchants are able to do through the platform.
It's interesting. I'm just thinking about other categories, like big ones. So you said 0%. It triggered me for, you know, cars. You know, occasionally when things get tight, the 0% offers come on. Do you see yourself getting into bigger and bigger ticket items like that someday?
We do, up to a point. I mean, I think right now what we're actually focused on is smaller items being able to satisfy a larger share of consumers' purchases by making sure we're available everywhere that they're, that consumers shop. So focusing on building a direct-to-consumer product through the Affirm card, which is just taking this concept and applying it to what is a debit card, where you can decide in flow whether you want to pay for something now or whether you want to pay for over time and still use the same instrument to achieve that. That really starts to unlock things like offline, which is obviously a huge category. It makes that offline shopping experience much easier, much smoother. And so that's a big focus. And as a part of that is really covering the broader breadth of smaller purchases for consumers. But yeah, we do also talk about going up the purchase size towards larger purchases.
So many places you could go, and your wheelhouse has always been e-com. Those of you that haven't used them yet, I see you going into brick and mortar. I know you've been playing with it with Walmart and some others, and is that why you got into the credit card business today? You have like I think about almost 800,000 cards out there.
Yeah, it's actually not a credit card. It's a credit card competitor. It's a debit card that allows a per purchase decision of, I want this specific purchase to be paid over time. And again, the customer is deciding, this is how much it's going to cost me all in before they make the purchase. So still keeping that value proposition, that user experience that customers, provide us feedback that they really like, but doing it on a card, a physical card.
So if I'm in Walmart looking at a big screen, I can just go to the app and you'll say, hey, it's $62 a month, great. So that rather than going to the cashier and causing a long line.
Exactly. And then you get the barcode and you just scan it at the kiosk and you're on your way.
Got it. And, last thing on the business model, because not everyone understands. So, you get paid by the merchants and the consumers. Do you see that skewing one way or the other over the next, 5 years or so, going more towards the merchant side? Because you really are enabling them. But at the same time, you're taking a consumer risk.
Yeah, there is also some risk on the merchant side, especially small merchants. There's the consumer risk, consumers paying. I think that's a function of both the macroeconomic environment, which, I'm no longer trying to guess where that's going to go. Just running the business independent of wherever it goes and making sure we have a healthy business, as well as the merchant base. A lot of it is also driven, you said it earlier, based on their calendar and when they want to see more sales, larger sales, and what's motivating them. So, our goal isn't for any specific balance of merchants paying versus consumers paying. It's really is of trying to bring them together and create the most exchange of value that we can provide across both of them, so they both feel like they're getting something great out of that transaction.
Looking at your innovation pipeline, just back to that. So we've had a couple of the new emerging banks on, the ones that have been extremely well-funded and have their own credit card, but it's mostly for small business, SMB, not consumer. What do you think of is the SMB ever a category for you guys?
Yes, for sure. We've actually started some pilot programs with both Amazon and Best Buy around small businesses, starting with sole propositions.
For their merchants.
So, and that's where we've started, largely because it's a customer base that we understand, in the sense of we obviously see them on the merchant side already. And to a large extent, how they're funded and how they operate, they look a lot like a sole prop business, looks a lot like a consumer. And so a lot of our modeling, our tooling, all of that fits in. And so that was kind of the natural extension for us. But it's, that is just a path on the progression towards towards sole prop, from sole props to, limited
liabilities. Sole proprietors, is that what that means? Yeah.
Sole proprietors, thank you.
Huh. So, sorry to be digging into your pipeline so much, but, we're trying to get a understanding of what makes you guys tick, how you think. So what about, I mentioned Zelle, or however you pronounce it, again, the nine big dog banks funding that. The peer-to-peer transactions, what do you think of that area?
I think it's certainly an interesting area, and an area that has, obviously, like you said, a lot of participants in it. I think it's not something that is on the immediate roadmap. We're really thinking about how to bring consumers and merchants together, how to actually, create more value for consumers when dealing with merchants, and obviously merchants having the value of more customers. That, that bring having that level playing field of consumer to consumer, I think it's an area that is we'll explore, but I think it's probably a little further out than things like your previous questions about small businesses.
Yeah, because I love to sell my boat or a couple of jet skis and just tell the guy, hey, just scan it, and then it comes up, say it's $100 a month. The guy's like, oh, I can do this. it takes the negotiation off the $20,000 thing and breaks it down monthly. I think everyone's missing the boat on that one. Or maybe that's available. I don't know. Maybe they offer that. I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's definitely trickier. I think there's a real opportunity there. I think it's more a matter like any business, right? We have to decide what order we're going to take these things in, and do our best.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it, there's
as much as we can.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, when you think about it, there's 1.6 billion independent freelance contractors, or however you want to call them, around the globe. And it's just, it's always available cash, moving to available cash mode versus this kind of an idea. It's just making me think a lot. But let's go back to your current stuff. So you guys are doing an amazing job. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is on partnerships. So partnerships at Reboot, we think that is a key to massively accelerating companies. And companies that don't move as quick or grow as fast as you have just don't do them. So you've named the big ones, obviously, Amazon, Walmart, Target, major retailers, major e-com providers, all the way down to the little guys that are, on the exchanges, on Walmart Exchange, probably Kroger, probably. And so what can you teach, listeners here about partnering?
Great question. And, we also partner with Shopify is another one that we're excited about. And I mentioned them because...
How could I leave out
one? I mentioned them because they actually are, a really good example of what does it mean to work with a partner and work well with a partner.
And they were they were your initial big push, right?
They were definitely one of them. Yeah, one of the partner pushers. I think we had Walmart before them.
You did? Okay.
Shopify was certainly... it taught us a lot about partnering, and it was really interesting. It kind of gets to your question, which is in some ways the things that we were already doing, we realized through the experience of working with Shopify how valuable those things were to an organization, to a partner like Shopify. It's where it is really about working collaboratively with the other engineering team to the point where you have your team of product people and designers and engineers, and you have theirs, and it starts to feel like one combined team. And that I feel like is when it's going really well, is when you feel like you're in it together, shared goals, trying to drive the shared outcome. But in a really importantly, shared sense of urgency, shared sense of pace of how are we doing this together. So trying to remove a lot of things. A lot of times you see partner organizations where one partner just has a very different methodology to how they approach working and building. And it creates this impedance mismatch on pace and rigor and quality that can really create friction, not just in terms of how fast you're able to move, but also in terms of what it is that you value in delivering software, in delivering outcomes and products. And so I think that becomes really important is that understanding of what does your partner care about? How do they work? How do their teams operate? and work and putting in the time and effort to try to match them on what it is that they're doing and being a part of their team as much as being an independent organization.
Yeah, I often tell, depends on who I'm talking to, if it's the small company, I'd say I'm telling one thing, but if it's the big dog, I usually say, hey, listen, whatever they've asked for, give them more. Give the little company more, especially when you're first starting out, because they need it. They need the momentum. Mm-hmm. Don't get that last percentage. This is not worth it.
Yeah.
Make them a partner, not a, you know, not a vendor. The
That's great advice.
A lot of people listening in, you know, that $1 trillion in credit card debt throws people into a tizzy sometimes. So what do you say to the press that, you know, it goes around about how this, you know, buy now, pay later is just making it worse for people getting more and more into debt?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it is reasonable to be concerned about the level of indebtedness of the consumer. I think that's especially true in credit card debt, as it relates to revolving debt, right? Where purchases, you take your credit card, you're revolving on it because you bought a TV 2 years ago, and you know you're buying lattes and groceries and being charged interest on them because it's all in the same line. And so from our perspective, it has always been a view that there are purchases that are larger and relative to a person's monthly or biweekly cash flow, where there is value in having that item today versus later. And how do you provide access to credit in a way that the customer can make that decision? How can we help them understand how much is this going to cost to have it today versus spending the next 12 months saving for it and then buying it? And is that worth it to you? And part of that value has always been, the thing we show the customer, it will never cost more than the number we show. We don't charge late fees. We don't compound interest past what we showed you, even if you're delayed in your payments. It doesn't obviously revolve. It's closed-ended. And so we approached it from a credit is necessary. Credit is something, and debt is necessary for people to be able to, you know, create leverage in their own lives the way businesses and organizations do. And how do you do that in a way that is responsible? How do you do that in a way that is understandable to, you know, a typical consumer and that doesn't get them in trouble? And so, you know, there's a large amount of credit card revolving debt out there. We'd like to see that, you know, revolving debt certainly
You're definitely more friendly. You're more friendly than some credit card companies, I know, that's for sure. You guys must have some, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. So if I'm on, you know, a site buying a couch and another person's on exact same couch, exact same time of day, night, are we going to get the same rate, or do you actually have enough intel on each of us to change the rates?
We have enough information to change the rates. Yes,
we thought. Okay.
Each person, even purchase to purchase, will see different rates. Not definitely, but there's especially once a customer starts paying us back and we can see more of that interaction history between us and the customer, they will see improvements in rates over time.
Yeah. I know some of the airlines are using it to, you know, get people to make decisions, because a lot of times there's a hang up right there. But so how does, without getting too geeky here in your product line stuff, but does AI make this better for you or worse in the future? Because you guys have been doing AI for a long time. You're one of the early ones that we've worked with. Where do you see this going?
I think like any technology that and especially sort of large in the sense of big change technologies, you know, they always have their positives and negatives. You know, it's people behind it at the end of the day. And you know, because people have positives and negatives, you get that, you know, that flows through the technology. So, you know, on the one hand, we worry about large language models usage in fraud. And that's an area of investment for us, is how to detect, you know, fraud that's being driven by, and especially account takeover and things like that through large language models. On the other side, you know, the flip side, there's a lot of potential benefits around, especially around user education and understanding and putting it into words and terms and that customers understand about what's happening, why are these decisions happening, how does the product work, you know, support and servicing. So there's a large amount of opportunity there. I think from the perspective of the actual modeling we do on credit, that is an area where we're very focused on. Yes, we use modeling to come up with our results for our credit decision and our pricing, but they are strictly deterministic. This is an area where we feel pretty strongly, even though the, you know, even though one purchase might versus another purchase might have different pricing based on things like the merchant subsidizing some of the risk. The way we got to that answer is deterministic, and it's something that we think is really important, is to be able to make it explainable, understandable, and repeatable. Obviously something that large language models by design are not intended to do. And so that those for us are in a different domain of how we think about leveraging them for the business outside of the credit decision.
Yeah, that's why I asked. I think you, I don't know, in a way are way ahead of the market just with your own algorithms. Let's talk about some fun stuff without getting going. So how do you keep this all going? What's the, you know, when you look at growth and innovation, you know, you can build stuff inside, you can partner and borrow it, you can acquire things, you know, how do you kind of look at that, and you know, what's your innovation culture like?
Great question. I mean, I think that that acquisition partner build is, you know, part of that question for us is always how close is it to the center of what we do? You know, I think as we think about, well, is it's not really a core capability. It's something that we're not necessarily need to be experts in. We really aggressively look at partnering, buying solutions there and incorporating them. As you get closer to the center of what you do and really the core differentiator, not only is it an area where we continue to invest in order to be able to continue to learn and be able to deliver value, you know, when you think about it also, because it is the core of what you do, it's also something that's harder to integrate into or replace because it is the it has the sort of most active surface area of development, of investigation, of experimentation. And so it makes it, that activity makes it actually difficult to just bring something in from the outside and just jam it into the center of what you do versus as you get kind of further out to the outer edges of the onion, you know, bringing in, you know, a CRM or some other capability has much more definitive and limited surface area in terms of how it plugs into your product. And so that also helps to answer the, you know, the question of, should we build it or should we buy it? Should we partner or should we continue to innovate?
Yeah, great answer, by the way. A lot of people struggle with that with the question because it's too much going on out there. You can't just, I know other companies have built everything themselves. There's $1 billion companies going to be on the week before you and can't argue with their approach. Man, it's worked well. You know, Libor, I really want to appreciate you, you know, being on. And what, tell us about yourself. You know, if you had a personal challenge, a struggle in your life that you've overcome that got you to where you are now?
I think...
We call it a reboot, so sorry. I didn't mean to use hard words like challenge, but yeah, have you rebooted yourself over the years?
You know, I think for me, I started out my career very as an engineer. I got my computer science degree from University of Illinois, which is actually where I met our, you know,
know it well,
CEO at a firm. And so I started out as a, you know, diehard building software, everything from supercomputing to, you know, to software for other engineers, tools, all of that. And the first three startups I worked on were all, for me, very focused on the technology and how we can build better software and how we can deliver results through building software. I think it was after those three startups where, for me, a reboot was around the getting very interested in the product and the business itself and understanding that larger, for me, larger systems problems of how people come together to deliver products to solve business outcomes and how that works. And so that has been really interesting in how I've stayed very engaged is sort of moving more into a business operating role that spans not just engineering, but kind of the whole enchilada.
Yeah. So how'd you learn the rest of it? Was it by doing?
I think it's by doing. I think that's the best way to learn. You know, you bring your skills with you, so you have to have skills that matter to what's happening. But they also create, those skills also create the opportunity to get involved in everything that those skills touch, and learn about those areas and understand them. That, and surrounding yourself with smart people that you enjoy working with.
Yeah, amen on that. The if I went down to U of I, which I've been down there, taught there, and done a couple of speeches, or maybe if you went down there, what would you tell students to focus on before they graduate so they're better prepared?
I'd probably be talking to computer science students. You know, I think actually anything, maybe. Any kind of student that I'd be talking to, you know, it really is find the things that you know, make sure the thing you're working on in terms of skill sets and capabilities are the things that you're genuinely interested in. You have to have that interest to sustain your attention span, because the only way, right, to succeed is to become good at that skill. And the only way to be good at a skill is to do it a lot. And the only way to do it a lot is if it's actually something that you enjoy doing, and that is fun, and that feels productive to you. And so that's what I would tell them. I would tell them, you know, make sure it's fun and prepare yourself for doing a lot of it over the next, call it 5 to 10 years.
I like it.
As you get better.
Good advice. That seems to be missing a lot in jobs and companies, is the passion. So thanks for your input. You've been listening to Libor Mihalik. He is the president of Affirm. This is Dean DeBias with the Reboot Chronicles. I want to thank you for joining us today. We'll see you soon.